So welcome back to the High Tech Forum podcast. We've had a bit of a hiatus as I've been redesigning the audio room at the beautiful Lakewood, Colorado studios, and that's more or less done now. So we're back on track today. I'm going to be interviewed by Shane Tews. Those of you who are regular listeners of the podcast know who she is. She's a pretty much a worldwide internet governance and policy expert who I'm always glad to talk to. Hi, Shane.
Hi, Richard. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Did you have a good Thanksgiving?
I did. I was out your way in Colorado enjoying the beautiful weather, even though there was no snow.
Yeah, it's not really acting like winter in Colorado yet.
It's not acting like winter in D.C. either, which actually in D.C. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, they don't really handle winter too well there. Yeah, that snow thing, it's kind of like shocks people. Well, that's okay. They handle the snow about as well as they handle public policy, so I guess that's probably what you are.
Well, while I had time in airports, I really enjoyed reading your recent report, You Get What You Measure, and it's made me think every time I get on a web page, whether it's on my computer or my iPad or especially my mobile device, how interesting it is to see what is being loaded and how long it takes to actually load something when I do a click through. So thank you for making me cognizant of that, but it also made me realize how many people misunderstand what the importance of speed is and what actual speed of load time is for a website. Do you mind walking through that a little bit?
Yeah, it's a really interesting, and I think as you say, it's a pretty vital thing to understand. Today, there's a discussion on one of the mailing lists that the Internet Society operates about net neutrality regulations, in which a couple of people who were not really the most technical who were in the discussion were talking about, you know, speculating about the implications that come from ISPs speeding up or slowing down websites. And the thing that I found is that consistent with the FCC's findings, since it's been measuring broadband network performance pretty intensely since 2010, and in their approach to the measurement is they report speeds for the broadband network itself, but then they also look at some applications. In particular, they look at how fast web pages load. And what their findings have shown for about the last 4 to 5 years is that if the broadband speed is below 12 to 15 megabits per second, it has a big impact on how fast web pages load. So if you upgrade your broadband connection from 5 to 10 megabits per second, you'll see a big difference in web page load time. But if you keep on upgrading, if you already have 15 and you go up to 25, 50, or even 100, you're not going to experience really noticeably faster web page load time. And the reason for that is the non-technical, you know, community, I guess you could say people, tend to assume that the network is what dominates all the performance. But in fact, the network is only one of the factors. So you also have the performance of your computer. You have the complexity of the web page. You have how much server capacity the website has and where it's located, if they're using a content delivery network or if they aren't. But I think probably most significantly is the density of advertisements on the page. So while you're looking at a web page and it's populated with ads, each of those individual ads tends to come from a different server, which is not the same one that the main page text comes from. And so those accesses to those, and what's actually going on with a lot of those ads is that an auction is taking place between the time that you click on the link to the website and you see the ad. And that auction takes time, and the time it takes is completely independent of what the network capacity that your ISP has. And any sort of traffic engineering or prioritization or manipulation that your ISP does, for the most part, it's in the noise.
Yeah, you know, video, online advertisements, you know, degrading the speed from a fully loaded page, and especially news websites, how bloated they are with, what did you say, 6,000 or 6,500 distinct requests and 130 domain names trying to link on that. And I love when you say there's basically abandonment after 3 seconds. Are we asking web developers and the ISPs to do an awful lot in 3 seconds?
Yeah, they're actually free to do what as much as they want, right? I mean, I think their calculation is that the more ads they can show, the more money they can make.
Yeah, I guess the question though is, when does the quality of the experience degrade? You don't call it abandonment. You have another phrase, but
bouncing.
Yes, where people bounce off the site because they get tired of waiting.
Yeah, I mean, this is something Akamai is now doing pretty thorough reports about e-commerce, in which they look at these factors like what is it that makes a visit to an e-commerce website successful? And it's basically, you know, the definition for that would be if you go to an e-commerce site that you haven't visited before and you sign up, you know, you create an account there or you buy something, that was a successful visit. But probably if neither one of those two things happen, or maybe if you put something in your shopping cart but don't actually pay for it, they might regard that as a successful visit too. But there's kind of a fine line between how much advertising the site can show you and people's willingness to stick around and basically take the abuse.
Yeah, the third-party trackers, as you mentioned, they're doing the auction, obviously have a play in that as well. So what are the better performance tools that we should be looking at? It sounds like we're not measuring what the consumer is actually considering to be a load time. We've misinterpreted it to just be the upload speed or, you know, to the website. And we're not looking at all the other items, the fragmented delivery chain along the way.
Yeah, for the consumer, we really don't have good tools. We don't have tools that really enable us to understand how well designed the web pages are and who to blame when things don't work well. And I think that's actually one of the things we need to see an emphasis on the creation of. I think consumers, if you have an unsuccessful visit to a web page, you tend to blame it all on the ISP. Sometimes it is the ISP's fault, but sometimes it's not. And we really don't have any way to distinguish.
Yeah, you note that the party with the greatest insight, which is the ISP, has the least control or the ability to exercise control around the quality of the experience, even though most time they get the blame for what the consumer thinks is a lack of speed for loading.
Yeah, I think it might be useful. This is kind of speculative, but the website owners and developers, if they could actually get access to some of the data that can be collected by ISPs close to the consumer, they could determine, you know, what the relative speed of their page load is. And there could be issues involved with transit companies that are in between the websites and the users could be slowing things down. And the website operators may think they're delivering their pages with lightning speed when they're actually not.
So the web developer could also use the tool to see what third-party elements or what it is that might be slowing down their website if we were all using the same measurement tools.
Yeah, and the assumption that underlies most of the efforts to do internet measurement is, I think, they're based on the models that were developed for measuring the speeds in local area networks, where the network is extremely uniform. It's like it's all your network, and there aren't like multiple parties involved. But in the internet, there can be multiple parties involved in handing off the packets from the sender to the receiver. I mean, they can go through a couple of different transit networks, and they may go through a couple of different ISPs as well. And each of those parties is capable of slowing things down, and none of them is really capable of speeding them up, you know, above like what the rate at which they receive the packet.
And you also comment about a company called Samnose Whitebox that has an open source researcher tool that we could be doing more with that. If it's open source, can more people be using that as a baseline or as a way to be doing measurement tools?
Yeah, the Samnose Whitebox is it's part of the system that the FCC uses. Samnose is a company based in England that does internet measurement for lots of different, mostly national regulators. So their system is used in the US, the UK, several other European countries, Singapore, Japan. And it's pretty much the world standard in broadband performance measurement for regulators. And their system is built on an open source. It's basically like a home router that's been customized to do network performance monitoring. And it's an open source box, and it's capable of doing a whole lot of things that more than what it does today. So I think there are some opportunities where we can identify applications that need tighter measurement. It's possible to implement those measurement systems and put them in the SAMNOS white box.
And so will that help with network congestion as well as the end user experience? If they just from an understanding, predictability, or what is it that we'll be getting out of, getting more measurement tools that are more accurate?
Well, the only thing that the SAMNOS can do is pretty much tell you what things look like at the point where the data is ready to be given to the consumer. And they can also tell you what's happening at the point how fast the consumer is delivering stuff to the internet. It can't identify like a congested internet exchange. So you need different measurement tools to do that. And that's the sort of thing that Casey Claffey and David Clark are working on now. She's got a system that's based on Raspberry Pis that she installs in internet exchanges to look for congested edges, for what they call when the edge is running hot, the boundary between, say, one of the ISPs and one of the transit providers. So it detects those kind of scenarios.
And then towards the end of your piece on measurement, you talk about increasing the user satisfaction will be a benefit, would eventually be replacing some of the legacy parts of the internet. And I know that there's network virtualization going on in software-defined networking. Is that happening at a speed that consumers can notice? I know that we're seeing a slowdown in broadband investment from recent reports, but it sounds like the ISPs are trying to figure out how to get things to the browser flows to different servers in a faster level for what their part of the journey is.
Yeah, I mean, they are. The software-defined networks and network function virtualization, which are two very closely related but subtly different things, are becoming more and more a reality in the modern internet. And some companies in particular are moving ahead with that faster than others. And the significance of this for consumers is that when the companies that provide networking are using equipment that actually benefits from the Moore's Law advances in semiconductor performance and efficiency, that produces cost savings and benefits will, I think, eventually trickle down to consumers in the form of higher speeds, lower prices, greater reliability, and a better ability to customize services, network services, around the needs of applications. So that is happening. And it's it really couldn't happen until quite recently, because you need to have an awfully powerful generation of integrated circuits to make that work. But we have that now, so we can.
And will that also will benefit from all that when we eventually get to 5G, the lauded 5G we're all waiting for?
Oh, this is absolutely critical to the successful implementation of 5G, because you, instead of a single backbone or a small handful of backbones that control the rate at which traffic is transported, with software-defined networks, you can essentially have backbones that have the performance characteristics that are needed everywhere and anywhere all the time. So it pretty much acts as if, instead of having one physical network that does a whole lot, that does whatever it does, you have 100 virtual networks, each of which can be tuned to the requirements of particular applications.
That seems like it would be, just from a distribution load, it's a huge leap. One of the fun conversations I had over Thanksgiving was with one of my brothers, and trying to explain the difference between content delivery networks. And well, ultimately he's been reading on Reddit that the internet is going to die, and it's the current chairman of the FCC's fault. So I tried to have a long, thoughtful discussion with him about that. But, getting to kind of one of the other main topics that's going on in DC right now, it's a challenge sometimes to explain to somebody that all they want is what they want when they want it, that how this whole process works and the cost of the delivery and the investment, and the challenge that if we don't put the right regulations in place, there is a lack of interest in investing in things that are going to bring us 5G, that will bring us the fiber that we need, to get the next generation networks running.
Yeah, the end of the internet as we know it, it's been imminent since, in 2005, now Senator Ed Markey, who then was a member of the House of Representatives, issued a press release on a bill that he was trying to pass. And the title of the press release was "The End of the Internet as We Know It."
And that was in 2005?
Yeah. And that's such a commonly used phrase. Scott Walston, the president of the Tech Policy Institute that does the Aspen Conference every summer, he went into NexusLexis and did a search on that phrase and plotted the frequency with which that's been in the press since about 2004. And the peak utilization was 2014, I guess the time when the advocacy groups and the foundation-funded folks were pushing back against Tom Wheeler's then plan to continue to use Title I on internet service providers, which has actually been the norm in internet law since forever. I mean, it's the Computer II inquiry in 1980 said that was the way to do it. The modified final judgment in 82 said that was the way to do it. The universal service report that the Kennard FCC issued in 1998 said Title I is the best fit for ISPs, and you know, that had continued to be the norm until 2015, when Chairman Wheeler was persuaded, after initially proposing a Title I framework, to switch to Title II in order to sort of secure the legal authority to impose some fairly strict regulations on practices that pretty much don't really happen, like site blocking and throttling and paid prioritization.
Right. Well, I think about when Tim Wu had his first net neutrality paper in the early days of the web. Facebook didn't exist yet. Microsoft was still pretty dominant. Apple was not the company that we know today. Not sure where Amazon was at that point. Probably just an online bookstore.
Relative sizes of the telecoms and the web companies in 2002, when Tim Wu wrote his first proposal for net neutrality. And there were three telecoms that were in the top 50 or so. Verizon, AT&T, and SBC. This is before SBC and AT&T had merged. But yeah, the biggest one of the tech companies, I believe at that point, was Microsoft, which was in the top 100, but it's the only one that was. And then you had Apple and Amazon were on the list. Amazon just sort of barely made they were 485 or something. They barely made the list. And at that point, Google was still privately held and Facebook wasn't even an idea. But I mean, obviously things have changed an awful lot since then, because those five tech companies that I just named are now the five most valuable corporations in America by market cap. So, Apple's number one, Google is number two, Microsoft is number three, Facebook is number four, and Amazon's number five. And so now the big guys, the argument, you know, that people were making for net neutrality, it was protection that was needed to prevent the big guys, meaning the telecoms, from abusing the little guys, meaning the tech companies. But now that the tables have turned on that and the big companies are the tech companies, do we really need regulation to protect them?
Seems
a bit questionable.
As we were discussing just a couple minutes ago, the idea of, you know, at the time you might have had single computers or just a few hubs that were running their networks, and now you have Amazon Web Services, which, you know, gives people great access and also protection to their content. And it's one of, you know, I never thought we'd see the government adopt something as fast as Amazon Web Services has become in the U.S. government space, as well as we see that in the commercial space, and it's migrating to the small business space.
Yeah, I mean, it's got a ways to go yet, because in terms of just content delivery networks, and I understand AWS is a lot more than a content delivery network. It's a cloud platform that provides you with processing, so you don't even have to buy your own servers. It's like number six. So Akamai is still the number one content delivery network. So yeah, and so that's the other argument as well. We need this to protect the little guys, but the little guys, I mean, face it, if you're extremely little, There's no financial incentive for an ISP to degrade your traffic and try to extract tolls from you because you don't have any ability to pay. And so it's the medium-sized guys, they're going to use content delivery network. And the content delivery networks have, you know, on good terms with the ISPs. It's a tight symbiotic relationship. They both make money off the fact that content delivery networks have fast lanes and they deliver traffic to end users, you know, faster than it could get there otherwise.
So like a company like Cloudflare, who has DDoS protection and is a major content delivery network, are they playing by the same rules as we're asking the ISPs to? Or, I mean, are they a different category?
That's a really important question because, you know, it goes to what the definition of infrastructure is. So we consider that, you know, the Title II classification in communications law applies to infrastructure, to telecom infrastructure companies. And then if you're not an infrastructure company, you're a user. And so you're obviously not regulated because the communications law doesn't really care about the behavior of users. They only care about the behavior of providers. But without these companies like Akamai and Cloudflare, I could argue even Twitter and Google search, the internet as we know it wouldn't really exist. So the internet as we know it depends on a lot of infrastructure, good behavior by infrastructure companies. And we've seen, you know, that Cloudflare has the power to limit the access that extremist groups have to the rest of the world, which is actually fine by me. But they're an unregulated company. They're a Title I company. So it's a curious situation where internet service providers that serve retail customers are regulated one way and internet infrastructure companies that serve businesses are regulated a different way. You know, and going back to the Kennard order that I was talking about in 98, when that was written, there was still really active discussion going on in Congress about what to do with businesses that did commerce over the internet. And in this, the classification question was really lively then between Title I and Title II. And actually some senators maintained that email should be treated as a common carrier service because the classical definition of common carrier in the communications law is that delivering information between points of a user's choosing without any alteration in the form and content. And, you know, when I send you an email message, you theoretically get the message that I send you. You know, the headers may change on it, but it's my text is delivered to you. And so their argument was, well, that fits very conveniently within the confines of Title II and communications law, but the FCC rejected that analysis.
Well, that's very interesting because I think the end user, going back to this discussion I had with my relatives, you know, they just don't understand the different layers of the technology. You had a podcast this summer where you talked to the internet pioneers, where you did a great discussion on that. And I recommend anybody who wants to go back and listen to it. But you know, this, the idea of what was created and how it is currently used are vastly different in almost every point. And that things like TCP and HTTP were just, you know, initial thoughts of how to structure the process. And yet they've been kind of, they now are the cornerstone. From when I hear you talk about it, I think maybe you're wishing we'd move beyond, we'd go beyond that onto a newer technology.
Yeah, I used to be very concerned about the fact that TCP, it does such a terrible job of some of the things that it has to do, like internet congestion control. And it doesn't really have the point of view to be able to do that correctly because TCP has this throttling mechanism built into it where if it senses network congestion, it reduces the rate at which it transmits. But every individual TCP session that is doing that is unaware of what's going on in the rest of the network and the rest of the shared pipes that it's using. So it's having to make that calculation on the basis of insufficient information. We actually need to have a system in which parties that have better vantage points, like the routers that can observe the rate at which traffic arrives from a particular port, could signal in some way that it would be wise to reroute the traffic. I mean, so we actually, I think, need some dynamic routing to deal with temporary congestion scenarios, and the BGP doesn't really support that very well. There's a lot of research work that's gone on for the last 20 years trying to improve that, but it's complicated by the fact that people have contracts. The firms who are internet users, commercial users, have contracts with their suppliers, and there's a limited amount that can be done with dynamic routing. But there are a lot of shortcomings like that. But I think when we take all of these pieces of the traditional internet and wrap them up in the software-defined network scenario, we have the opportunity to actually make these kind of adjustments from a more comprehensive viewpoint with operating on the basis of better data about what's going on in the network at any given time. So I think we can probably continue to live with TCP, even though it's somewhat less than ideal.
Well, it does sound like you've pointed out there's several workarounds that just kind of envelop it and allow it to move forward.
Yeah, you throw enough bandwidth at the problem and enough software and enough processing power, you can pretty much make a bumblebee fly.
Well, that's good for all the people who like the fact that the internet is going to continue to work even after December 15th.
Yeah, one of the things that really comes across to me in this net neutrality discussion, more than anything else, I think people who are heavy internet users fear disruption.
The irony.
Isn't it? I mean, the internet is people like Larry Downs have written books about how the internet is a great disruptor and it really has upended all these industries. I mean, the travel industry and newspapers and entertainment are so different now than they were before the internet. It's disrupted all these other industries, but no, we don't want the internet disrupting itself. That's going too far.
Right. And you had another podcast this summer with Brett Swanson, where you talk about just the economic capability that the internet has provided, the exponential, and what we have to look forward to with Internet of Things and artificial intelligence and the ability of, machine to machine, not only learning, but manufacturing and, 3D printers. You have a great point that you make about, we're living in a one-size-fits-all world, and eventually we'll be able to customize things at both a macro and a micro level. And we have all that to look forward to if we continue to encourage investment in this space.
Yeah, but I think there is, this is why it's so important for us to get the policy right, because a lot of these new technologies and new capabilities they raise questions about the impact that they have on society. And I think the kind of thing that really makes people stand up and take notice of this is that, President Trump's not exactly the most popular president in history. And it's pretty difficult to imagine a scenario in which he gets elected where there's no such thing as Twitter. I mean, it was obviously, played a vital role in the campaign, right?
Yeah.
And Congress is actually having hearings today on that very subject of how to regulate services like Twitter and algorithm-based services and, what to do. And they're going to I haven't seen it yet, but I think what they're going to end up doing is rehashing a lot of those issues about the regulatory status of Twitter and email that the Congress was looking at in the mid-90s when the Telecommunications Act was written.
Yeah, we have a lot of things that we think we had solved that are back up on the plate. I mean, we have Senator Al Franken is now looking to, possibly regulate the end user, the end-to-end companies, the tech companies, in a similar fashion to what the ISPs have been dealing with the last couple of years. We also have the advent of Europeans coming in with the General Data Protection Initiative, which will recently, I saw yesterday that Facebook has a new tool where they can, they can monitor people's behavior, which is its own frightening capability, but they're not going to implement it in Europe because they're concerned about people's privacy. And so people are starting to look at, all this information and how the data flows. And I feel like we have data bloat. We have a lot of information out there. And so far, the only people that have figured out how to use it well are the advertising companies. But there's a lot more opportunity there.
The weirdest thing that I've seen recently is the Facebook suggestion that they can protect people from revenge porn if they would simply send nude photos of themselves to Facebook so they can scan them and catalog them and have those on hand just in case, the ex-boyfriend or ex-girlfriend posts some unflattering pictures in it.
I'm fascinated that that works for adults, but somehow they, still have a problem protecting underage minors. Yeah.
I just can't even imagine how that idea escaped the conference room in which it was originally floated.
Well, that's part of the fun of the internet.
I mean, it just seems to me like somebody should have just rolled on the floor laughing and said, yeah, I think you need to rethink that, dude.
Well,
people just don't trust us that much.
They do have that's an interesting sense of trust that you have with a provider. And
yeah, I think there are probably ways they could, and it's been pointed out, well, you know, you could sort of let people have access to the software that compresses these pictures, and they could run that on their own pictures and then sort of send you the key that they would use to match a pattern match against pictures and determine whether they're, you know, violative or not, without actually having to send the pictures, the raw photos to Facebook for their use. So yeah.
This is why I love getting to ask the engineer, because you always have a unique point of view on things that are probably much more efficient if one needs to solve that problem.
The idea that they could block revenge porn, it's actually built on this thing that YouTube does with some of the, one of their anti-piracy measures is that rather than movie studios having to issue takedown requests for pirated movies, you know, like every time it's reposted, because, you know, they notice and takedown just means that, you know, somebody complains to the to YouTube takes it down, then somebody else puts it back up, so you complain again, and so you just sort of endless whack-a-mole thing. So YouTube developed an algorithm so they can analyze movies and songs when they go up and look into a database of signatures that's been provided to them by the content creators, and where they find a match, they just refuse to put it up to begin with. So problem solved. That's the technique that, you know, Facebook wants to use. So it's a doable thing. They just kind of had a half-baked implement or idea about how to make it work.
Well, you make a good point that there is an interesting element to the technology. Maybe they'll have a different use case for it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, any other thoughts on the upcoming vote on December 12th on Title II, our three bright line issues of no throttling, no paperization?
Yeah.
The world coming to an end.
Yeah. 14th, actually, but to me, the net neutrality is the fact that it's devolved into three bright line rules. It's sort of like, you know, when there's a principle I've discovered in Washington that if you want to pass a bad bill, what you have to do is give it three words in the name.
Uh-huh.
Do not track, do not call. So do not call is actually kind of a good idea. Theoretically, for a while, reduced the number of spam calls we got, but, you know, doesn't make any difference now that people can spoof their origin phone numbers. Do not track, another thing that, you know, that rode through Congress, you know, quickly on the strength of the great reputation that do not call had in those days, is that produced absolutely nothing, right? It was a complete and utter waste of time that produce no benefit. And net neutrality, now that it's been boiled down into three bright line rules, it's really become sort of a caricature, because, you know, website blocking is just something that doesn't happen without a good reason. Even our friends at Free Press, they tried to find an example of that happening in the U.S. to put on their list of horrible situations that net neutrality is supposed to prevent. They couldn't find an example of that happening in the U.S. The only sites that get blocked are the ones that have been ordered by the courts to be taken down. And throttling, you know, ISPs don't really throttle websites either. I mean, it's the websites are actually doing a whole lot more self-throttling than the ISPs are doing. And this paid prioritization, I mean, we can't even come to an understanding of what it means. On this Internet Society mailing list today, a couple of people that are very well known in the world of networking, Fred Baker, who I've done a podcast with, and a guy named Vint Cerf that works for Google, were saying that neither one of them has any issue with making priorities of transmission priorities available for companies to purchase, as long as the terms and conditions are fair and uniform.
And isn't that part of the new rule that are going to discuss and vote on, is that you'll have transparency around all those items? If anybody chooses to do that, as Vint Cerf saying, the idea is okay. Yeah. You just tell people you're going to do it.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, nobody's done it yet, because it's never really been clear that the FCC would let you do it. But I think as long as the Chairman Pai is in charge of the FCC and the Restoring Internet Freedom Order is in effect, I think companies will be able to offer the kind of, you know, say, high quality voice transport that Dan Berninger wants for his startup. They'll be able to do that. And it may turn out to be completely unnecessary. And maybe that, you know, the people that have said the best efforts level of delivery is is just perfectly fine by itself. So at least we get to run the experiment on a large scale and see what happens. Cool. And I think in general, that's what the, you know, the internet needs more. We need more experimentation. We need more crazy ideas at the network transmission level than we've been able to have in the past, when we were just afraid of, you know, would the networks even be powerful enough to handle the traffic volume? They're powerful enough now. The traffic volume is not growing at such an eye-popping rate anymore. And I think we actually have the opportunity to look at some of the different technical solutions that can help us to make the internet support a broader range of applications and be more resilient against some of the issues that it faces. So let's do more. Let a thousand flowers bloom. Somebody said that.
Well, as we are migrating from, you know, watching cat videos and sending emails to machine to machine and AI, and wanting to do a lot more in areas of industrial use and, you know, potentially healthcare, which could benefit, you know, a lot of people around the globe, we're going to need that. I think traffic volume will.
We absolutely are. Well, great. So,
thank you, Richard, again for your time. I always learn, and I highly recommend people read your study. It's interesting.
Yeah, visit the High Tech Forum website, and if that's not where you found out about the podcast, and you can see that. So I published a research paper recently. I'm doing a couple of op-eds. There have been several blog posts recently that deal with some of these issues that we discussed today. In the upcoming weeks, I've got 4 government speakers that are in the queue that are looking at trying to get the approvals from their departments to join the podcast. So I think that's probably what we're going to do for the rest of the year, is a focus on government actors who have been somewhat lacking from the roster at High Tech Forum podcast. So tune in. We should have another podcast up in a couple of weeks, and leave us some comments, give us some feedback. Your host, Richard Bennett.